So, here we are reading about the conductor and the way the conductor conducts. And actually, the more I worked with this section this week, the more I thought that it's just a wonderful image. Because in one way, the conductor walks out on stage. I mean, I'm thinking about the conductor at in a symphony hall. So the conductor walks out on stage, and everybody falls silent, and the orchestra falls silent, and then the conductor lifts the baton and begins conducting. And it seems as though the conductor at that point is the most powerful person in that space. And in a sense, that's true. But in another sense, everything is already set up. The conductor cannot do anything, excuse me, cannot do anything that hasn't been rehearsed. And he can't bring in any new instruments that aren't in the orchestra, and he can't conduct any music that's not in the score. It's all set up in advance, and that really is that really is what I think Rinpoche is pointing out when he's using that image. There is another side to conducting which doesn't come up in this reading. I think it may be mentioned later. And that is that in English we have a second meaning for the word conduct, which is the way a wire or any other substance conducts electricity, or you can conduct sound. And if you think about that image, that's even less, there's even less freedom involved in that. The wire has no choice. It has to conduct the electricity once the electricity is being sent. So there's also that element. But I think the main focus is this idea that the conductor is seems to be very powerful, but actually is completely constrained by the circumstances of the situation. There's a passage. You might say, well, wait a minute. Conductors are artists, right? And some conductors are considered superb practitioners of their art. So what makes them different? Well, from a TSK perspective, and this is mentioned in this chapter, there's a freedom around the edges. You have the music, you have the score, you have the players, you have the orchestra, you have the rehearsals, you have the whole situation of being in the hall. All of that constrains you, but then you have some room around the edges. Now, from an artistic point of view, you might say it's not the edges, that's the beauty of what the orchestra creates. It's right at the center of the experience of music. And that may be true. And to that extent, you'd say, well, the image doesn't take account of that. But the basic image is that we're locked into a situation. And we've been exploring this, we explored it last term, and actually maybe even the term before that, especially when we focused on the past and how we are bound by the past. And that's really, we're really presenting that same idea here in a different way. The conductor is bound by everything that has come before. Now, all the examples that I gave about how the conductor is bound are kind of external circumstances. They've been rehearsing this music, and there's all these expectations and so on. But in fact, what Rinpoche emphasizes, when we look at the actual description here, and what matters for us is not the external circumstances so much, but the internal. So at the bottom of page 117, right at the start of the reading, Rinpoche talks about this, and he says the range of what we can conduct is sharply restricted. So that's like the music, the score, all that, but we're talking internally. So what is the range of what we conduct? And then he says thoughts, emotions, and memories that stream through the senses and the mind. That's what we have to conduct. We have to conduct in accord with thoughts, emotions, and memories. And it's even more subtle than that. As he points out, the thoughts, emotions, and memories themselves are based on certain attitudes, on a reduplicating of what has come before. There's a description on page 119. The line, this is about 10 lines from the bottom. The line of experience automatically extends. Associations linked to what has come before, names to language, qualities to comparisons, powerful images take control, experiences array themselves like court attendants in the service of a powerful ruler. Everything conspires, but it's the level that we're interested in is the internal level. Where thoughts, emotions, and memories, based on associations and the structures that have been laid down in the past, all of that is the problem. All of that is what keeps us from being free. Or you may remember last quarter we emphasized a number of times the image that it's just a line in one of the chapters that says. Inquiring into the nature of time means inquiring into whether we can be truly alive. So you could talk about freedom or you could talk about being truly alive. Either way, the point here is that neither of those is available. Everything has been shaped in advance. And, you know, in the reading last week, Rinpoche says that's implicit in every moment. He says, from one single thought, this is on page 117, he says, from one single thought, almost from one single word, we could conduct the whole. So that's all a little bit discouraging. In a sense, you might say, well, you know, the reason that we find ourselves in this place where, we come to the conclusion that everything is established, nothing is possible, the reason that is kind of the dominant theme today is in part because we're in the middle of a chapter, right? We're reading very carefully and very slowly, so we have to get clear on this point. It's absolutely central. But it's obviously, just in case anybody's feeling very depressed, having read this, just keep in mind that's the situation that we're being asked to acknowledge. That's the truth of the situation. And we want to get in touch with what is making that happen, but also just in a kind of a straightforward way, we want to be able to get familiar with it. So we're going to do an exercise in a few minutes where I'll ask you to look at that. But for now, I'm just going to lay it out a little further. If you ask in this chapter, and it's been discussed in previous chapters, previous readings, but if you ask right here, what is it? Why is it that we just are conducting the predetermined, the pre-recorded, the reduplicated, I'm just looking at page 119, the reprinted, the preserved, the duplicated, all these things that have all set everything up in advance, and all we can do, you might say, is walk out on stage and conduct. it's as though we were, you could imagine a movie where some world famous conductor is kidnapped and taken to some dictatorship, some country where a dictator is in charge, and they put him out on stage and say, here, you have to conduct this. It's kind of like that. You know, we're at gunpoint. That's a little too strong. But at gunpoint, we are forced into the role of being the conductor. There is a, everybody's muted, which makes it, well, not everybody, but I see some people are muted. It makes me feel a little like I'm speaking into a vacuum. I realize there's a reason for muting, to see if that helps with the sound, but maybe you could try unmuting people. Ooh, I see why you did. Okay.
We're here.
Yeah, you're here. Good. I'm glad to know that. Okay, let's see if we can do it with... Yeah, but there is somebody, but there's feedback from somebody. So maybe we can try, Kathleen, maybe you could try one at a time. I'm just feeling a little isolated here. So anyway, I was just going to mention a movie that I saw recently that some of you may have seen called Up in the Air. And I won't go into the movie at all, but at one point, the main character is giving a speech. He's a talk. He's a motivational speaker. And he has this idea that he's worked out over a long time about how you should be living your life, you know, not being attached to things, basically. And at a certain point in the movie, he gets up to give this speech. And he starts to give it, and then he realizes that something has changed. Something has, you know, he no longer believes what he's saying. And at that point, he has no choice but to walk off stage. Because if you're going to conduct, it's set up in advance what there is to conduct. That's really the all. But it's kind of a, it's a very concrete image. You know? Now, you could say, well, I don't want to conduct. I don't want to accept that situation that I've been thrust into. I don't want to be in that role. I don't want to have to, you know, I'd rather improvise, let's say. Nowadays, people really like the idea of improvising. And it is, does stand as sort of a, you know, in music, you'd say it's different from working from a conducted, from an established score. But, you know, we don't have to go there. But in any event, you don't want to stay with the you don't want to stay with what's already been set up. So then you have to say, in the way Rinpoche approaches this, then you have to say, well, what is it? What is set up? You know, why is it that we find ourselves in this situation? And as I say, we've already looked at ways that he asks that question and some of the suggestions that he makes. But if we look here. On, let's see, where am I looking? I'm looking at, well, right now I'm looking at page 118. There's a particular phrase, I don't see it on the page right now, but it seems to me the key phrase. He talks about entities with fixed identities, and he talks about sequences of cause and effect. Right? That's what sets things up the way we are. Oh, here it is. It's the second full paragraph on page 118. He says, so what happens is we take a position. We kind of accept the role of the conductor. We accept the role of the self. We frame our conduct, that's just a little above. And then he says, having made these choices, we live in ways that are shaped by the sequence of cause and effect activated when entities with fixed identities interact. And part of that is we live in a particular world, but part of it is that we live with our own identity. Our own, as he says here, we're bound by our own personal history, we're bound by our past choices. Our creativity is possible only at the borders of the recognized. Right? That's what we talked about before. Where is it that the conductor can be creative? And then he says something that is very touching, we could say. And that is, at the end of this paragraph, he says, we lack the time that would let us seek new knowledge, and we lack the knowledge to discover a new way of being in time. And I say that's touching because it just brings home the stuckness of the situation. We only have one particular way of knowing because we only have one understanding of time. And in that way of knowing, there's only one way that we can understand time. So we've been exploring that by asking or by looking at other ways of understanding time, but more to the point, experiencing time. You know, we've talked, this is what we focused on a lot in the last program, was the possibility of coming in contact with the aliveness of time. And that's, you know, that's still what we want to be focusing on. Now David has a comment here, a question. He says, I'm okay with conducting, but I'd like to be aware I'm doing it so I can focus on other more fruitful endeavors if I choose, instead of conducting in a reactive way, unaware of what I'm doing. Well, yes, I think that is right. You know, you don't, we don't necessarily want to give up on this capacity we have for conducting, because that also involves ordering things. I mean, again, if we stay with the image, and I don't want to ride the image too hard, but if we stay with the image of the conductor, you could say if there were no conductor, at least in principle, you know, the orchestra would fall apart. The music would descend into chaos. I have read that orchestras can do pretty well without a conductor, actually. But in principle, that's the idea. So we'd like to stay with the conductor. But the point you raised, David, when you say, I'd like to be aware I'm doing it so that I can focus on other more fruitful endeavors if I choose. Yes, that's exactly what we'd like. We'd like to be free. We'd like to be able to make choices. We'd like to be able to go in a creative direction, and we'd like to be more alive. But there's this very strong momentum that pulls us in the other direction because we've made these commitments. You know, we take a position, we choose a focal setting, and we frame our conduct accordingly. And the tension, the dynamic here is how we can change that. And what we've been exploring for a while now is that we can change that by really looking at time directly. Or, again, looking is not the right verb. You know, verbs, in a way, verbs are the most important part of TSK, it seems to me, because, you know, nouns suggest different possibilities. They name different possibilities. But verbs have to do with enacting those possibilities. And so we don't want to say we want to look at time differently. We want to engage time differently. We want to activate the aliveness of time. That's what we've been exploring. So yes, you know, what you point to, David, and what the chapter is saying in many ways is that we want to be clear about what's going on. We want to understand this process. And that was the point, we looked at this last week, of conducting the story, right? Actually, he doesn't say it quite that way in that chapter. He just says we can the story of the conductor is meant to be a story which doesn't bind us in the same way as the stories that the conductor conducts. Now, conductors conduct music, but so I'm mixing those two things together. The story that the narrator tells or the witness testifies to, all of those bind us. All of those grow out of the commitments that we've made in advance. All of those grow out of the past. All of those grow out of the sequence of cause and effect. That's what we want to question. So let's see. Michael has a comment. Okay, he says, Jack, you're our conductor. and also the conductor of material in this chapter? Is there the possibility that material can be so rich, so challenging in everyday, to everyday impulses and conditioning, that the conducting is alive and dives into the unknown? Well, thank you. That's nice. Yeah, there is another possibility, isn't there? One of the questions we always have to ask ourselves is, if this picture that TSK presents again and again in different ways, that we're bound by the past, if this picture is real, then how can we ever break out of it? It seems like we're totally stuck. And that was the passage, the sentence that I just read. We lack the time that would let us seek new knowledge, and we lack the knowledge that would let us discover new ways of being in time. Totally stuck. We go round and round in this circle, and all we can do is duplicate what has gone before. But we know that that's not true. We know that there's creativity and aliveness and that new possibilities manifest. So you could say, okay, so Rinpoche says, well, yeah, around the edges, maybe you can be creative. But no, it seems like there are times when something opens in our lives that doesn't come out of the past. It comes out of some other place of knowing. And that's absolutely true. So how do you take that into account? Well, you could use the image of the conductor here, and you could say you could conduct a new way of being. Well, so who's this you that conducts it? When we're working together in these classes, how is the conducting, how is that different from the kind of conducting that Rinpoche is describing here? It's fundamentally different. And part of what we're wanting to understand is that fundamental difference. But I suppose the point of the chapter, this particular chapter, or this particular reading, really, is that we already have some guidance, some suggestions for how we can activate a different relationship to time. And it has to do with not trying to structure time, but instead turning to the aliveness of time. But we need to acknowledge and we need to explore the fact that even when we move in those directions, we keep falling back in to a pattern that conducts what has been established. We may have special moments, or we may find guides, who lead us into a new possibility, and it's very alive, but then we fall back. Doesn't have to be, but it tends to be. We fall back. And actually, I think the image at the bottom of page 118 is helpful here, and this will actually pretty much lead us into the practice. The image says, it's the last paragraph that starts on 118, as we conduct one situation and emotional reaction after another, that's the usual conducting, right? Our experiences, thoughts, perceptions, and reactions line up like beads on a necklace. So this is one of these lists that Rinpoche is just so good at, where he gives you in just a few words something you could explore for a long time. Our experiences, our thoughts, our perceptions, our reactions, each one of those is well worth exploring. But here I'm just focused on the image. He says, these all line up like beads on a necklace. The presence of one bead on the necklace assures that the next bead will be there as well. And you could say that we're very committed to a particular structure which is made up of one experience after another, one bead after another. And even when we break out of that into the unknown, the strong tendency is to go right back in. And everybody knows this. I mean, we all know this, right? If we have an experience or we have an insight or, you know, we are walking down the street and suddenly things seem more alive, more rich, and we realize, you know, we have a freedom that we don't usually experience. And that stays with us for a while. And then we find ourselves back in the usual framework. You know, we essentially turn our experience, that sort of aliveness, into its own bead. You know? And now we're safely back within the bead, the necklace, you know, the necklace of experience. That's just the way it is. So I do want to practice with that for a bit, but I want to make one more point, or I should say really turn to a possible response that Rinpoche anticipates here, and that is that in the first full paragraph, the next paragraph, is the first full paragraph on page 119. Rinpoche is discussing here the possibility that we could break out of this structure where we're always conducting the next thing, and one bead guarantees the presence of the next bead. He says, of course, we're free to imagine that the next moment might be completely different from the one preceding it, not just in content, but in its very nature as an experience or a moment. And that's a wonderful distinction that he makes here, because that's exactly what TSK is suggesting. You know, it's not just that you have an experience and you say, oh, you know, everything looked more beautiful, or I felt a sense of oneness or wholeness. That's great. That's really nice. But you'd say, well, that's an experience like the previous experience. It just differs in its content. It feels way better. It feels more rich and more alive. But if it's just another experience that is different in its content, then it won't be fundamentally different. You know, at that point, you could say, you know, the one bead on the necklace is more beautifully decorated than the previous bead. And, you know, you admire it and you enjoy it, but it's still a bead. But he's saying, no, there is a possibility that the next bead on the necklace could be not a bead at all. We could really break out. But he says, that if we imagine that possibility, that imagining doesn't have any power to it. He says it's hollow. It's more fantasy than imagination. And we might say, you know, somebody might say, not me. You know, I have these experiences. They were really, really meaningful for me. And that's fine if that's your experience. But he's saying there's a kind of an imagining, a fantasy quality to it. So, you know, one of the images that people like a lot in the first TSK book has to do with walking through walls. And if I remember correctly, the passage in the book says something like, you know, if we let go of our commitments, if we let go of our focal setting, our position, our commitment to subject and object and cause and effect and all of that, does that mean that we could so transform experience that we could, for instance, walk through a wall? And that really captures people's imagination, the idea, you know, because walls seem so, you know, they're the great representative of something that's solid and real and a barrier. You know, it's just the right image. So could we just walk through a wall? And in that, in the first TSK book, Rinpoche says, no, we couldn't walk through walls, but we could imagine a situation where a sequence takes place that you could describe as a walking through wall sequence. In other words, this is not the main reason I'm bringing this up, but it seems to me the purpose of that distinction in the first book, or what's being pointed to, is that if I'm committed to myself as the one who would walk through a wall, that commitment in itself guarantees that I won't be able to walk through a wall. But if I could let go of that commitment, there might be a walking through wall sequence. You know, so, but that, the reason I bring that up is just to say that's a great example of saying, well, you know, wouldn't that be amazing if I could do that? You know, but it's kind of a, yeah, it's an imagination, but it's more like a fantasy unless we have a way to let go of all of those commitments. That's the issue. So let's go, let's take a look here. Bruce has a comment. This description of inescapable stuckness is great at motivating the self to say, oh, no, you don't. Well, that's interesting. Yeah, I like that. I feel some creative energy building, like a subatomic particle confined in a tight space that starts to leap around more the more you close it in. I feel that acting on that feeling, however, in my usual ways, will be more conducting. So I'm interested more just in this building energy. Well, that's great. That makes sense to me as a kind of a pathway towards challenging. Because clearly, the point is not to say, oh my God, we're totally stuck. it's important to realize that. And then how do you respond? And so Bruce is saying, well, the self is good at saying, no, you can't do that to me. But if the self tries to respond, then it winds up conducting in the same patterns, the same ways, the self-centered ways. So we need to be able to understand the possibility that freedom and aliveness could really emerge at the most fundamental level. And that means, kind of as an aside, that means that, you know, it's not going to be in some dramatic experience necessarily, like walking through walls. I mean, people do have interesting non-standard experiences sometimes with TSK. But the real point is to engage that in the most ordinary moments, right? To recognize that what seems most ordinary and in that sense most stuck actually has within it a non-conducting, right? A freedom, so that you do come back to this point that the next moment might be completely different from the one preceding it. But you do it based on this insight that of stuckness. You know? So where Rinpoche says, he says, well, yeah, we could imagine that it could all be different, but that's hollow, more fantasy than imagination. And then he says, the truth is, that's an interesting phrase, the truth is that the past projects forward and the future appears. A tightly structured pattern reproduces itself in a steady, ongoing transition. It's all set up, right? This moment replicates the structures of the previous one. Okay. It's interesting that he says the truth is such and such, because I'm sure you all have the sense, I don't know that we've talked about it specifically, that, you know, in TSK, you're not really so concerned with figuring out what the truth is. So when Rinpoche makes a statement like this, because truth depends on structures, it depends on saying this is the way things are, and that's not what TSK is about. So when he says the truth is, he's really saying, this is what's presupposed by our commitment to what's already been conducted, and that's what leads to our continuing to conduct. Okay, so what I want to do as a practice, that's a little bit of an experiment here, is we'll take like 2 or 3 minutes for this, and you know, we did this practice in the last series, the last program, of just looking for what it is that is most alive in your experience right now. You know, it might be the sunlight. It might be your sense, to use Bruce's image here, although he probably lost some of that creative energy, but it might be the creative energy that's building from the sense of a kind of a rebellion against the idea of being stuck. Or it might be something you're anticipating is going to happen, or it might be your breath going through the body. You know, we've talked about this before. There's all sorts of possibilities. We just want to look for aliveness. We just want to look for, you know, Bruce says in his comment, the building energy, and that's one way of talking about it. So look for the aliveness, but also look for how you fall back into the sameness of the conducted, let's call it. How you fall back into the structure that is not alive. And it may be that that comes and goes, or it may be that, you know, maybe it doesn't, this doesn't work very well in this 3 minutes that we're going to allow. But the idea is, look for the aliveness and then look for how you fall back in. In the first DSK book, Rinpoche talks about the coming out experience. You know, you have a certain kind of experience which has a special flavor to it. And then there's the coming out. And that's kind of what we're looking for now. We're looking for how we fall back into the pre-established, the conducted. So let's try that for about 3 minutes, and we'll see what kind of experiences people have. Okay, so let's come back. The question, I guess what I'd like to hear from people on is that a distinction that you could explore in that very short period of time? The distinction between the aliveness that is not committed to a duplication, and the moment of falling back into. So I'm going to allow time for people to write, but or of course you're free to speak up. David has something here. David, you're always looking out at nature. That's that's very nice. I like that. So David says, looking out the picture window. Oh, we've got some terrible feedback. Okay. Looking out the picture window, struck by bright sunlight. Yeah, that's feedback of my voice. Okay. Struck by bright sunlight and shades of green leaves and a rolling field. So that's the aliveness, right? A no-boundary view, deep impact, emotional connection. Then I must conduct the story of my event. Right, it's true, and you know, in a way, this is very mean, what I'm doing here, because I'm saying, okay, now tell us what happened, you know. And that is definitely a moment of conducting. That is definitely a turning away, although in principle, there's no reason that the moment of conducting has to be that way. I mean, I don't know if you've had this experience. Well, I imagine you have, that you're conducting or you have a certain experience. And something about the aliveness of that experience stays with you as you start to write about it, or maybe talk
about
it.
That's exactly right.
Yeah. Okay. That was Bruce, right? I think that happens, you know, and there is something kind of, especially for me anyway, there's something especially powerful in that. Maybe it's because we're used to, you know, when we write or speak and comment on what has happened, we know very well what that feels like. And when instead it feels really alive, I find that very powerful. Okay. So, but nonetheless, by asking you to write something or say something about your experience, that is an invitation to fall back into the ordinary, you could say. Okay, we've got some other comments here. So Brigitte writes, embedded in a certain tiredness I feel today. That's interesting. You know, can you find aliveness within tiredness? No special reason not, it seems to me, but interesting. Okay, I can sense an aliveness. Okay, it's not where you were going, but I was just wondering about that. I can sense an aliveness when I look outside my window to the huge trees. After a long winter, tender, fresh green is just showing, branches moving in the wind. When I start to think, now I've seen it, I know it, then I fall out. Yeah, that's what we want to explore, exactly that distinction. The aliveness of nature, I think it's a very natural place to look. You know, an example that I've used, and I'm sure people use it all the time, is seeing a beautiful sunset or any other beautiful sight in nature, and then the moment you label it, now you're back in. So that's one place to find the distinction, is, you know, from the experience to the reporting on the experience, whether to yourself or somebody else. That's an easy place to look, and it's an important place to look. It's also possible that you can find the difference within, well, in a somewhat more subtle, at a somewhat more subtle level, where the experience continues, but what was alive in it has been toned down. I guess another example that I use a lot, some of you have heard me say this before, is it's like eating a wonderful pastry. The first bite has an aliveness to it. And the second bite, you know, it's very similar, but the aliveness, if you look carefully, is just not there anymore. You've already identified what it is, and you've lost that open appreciation. Okay, Karen says, is it even the knowing or the seeing? Let's see. Isn't even the knowing or seeing that we are conducting all the time helpful? In the moments of falling back, there is a kind of aliveness too. Well, that's a wonderful thought. I think that's great. You know, we really do want to be in a situation, or that's not quite the right way to say it. We would like to be able to discover or engage or live out the aliveness of each moment. And if you say, and this seems right to me, that there is a kind of a natural falling back, the question is still, well, why can't there be an aliveness in that? That's what you're saying, Karen. I think that's great. That's exactly right. Okay, Bruce writes, I'm not sure I understood this, but here's what came up. Immediately, I felt a sense of bright aliveness right at the center of my head, extending down into my heart. As I breathed into it, it evened out and began to match the milder feel of the rest of my body. So that's very interesting. I like that description. It evened out and began to match the milder feel of the rest of my body. As I settled into that stillness, then I found a shimmering aliveness right at the felt boundary between the stillness of my being and the activity buzzing around it, voices, children, outside sounds. The aliveness wasn't in those things, but in the edge between stillness and activity. Okay, well, that's very interesting. I'm not going to try to comment on it because we really should be ending up. And Michael has a comment here, or a report. My computer just tried to get in the way, but I'm back. Let's see. Sitting quietly with my breath and sensations, I felt that the flow, the free movement of whatever arises, is comfortable. And that worrying about how I was going to label it 3 minutes later would only squash that feeling. Yes. So that's, we've talked already about that tension. Right? So I didn't worry about it. It's as if the very process of trying to capture an experience is like putting a bird in a cage. More pleasant to raise the eyes to its flight overhead. Okay, well, that's very nice, and I will let you have that last word. This distinction, I think this is a good thing to explore. It's very consistent with what we've been talking about in this chapter, the aliveness and the conducting and the transition, the shift between the two. Does it have to be a transition? How much is it involved with reporting to ourselves? Is it still operating even if we don't report? And can we keep it alive? Can the aliveness maintain itself even within an act of falling back into the ordinary? Isn't there aliveness in that also? So I'm summarizing some of the things you said, I just encourage you to keep working with that. Good. So we'll talk next week.